to Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Stay tuned for my very special guest host, Bruce Robert Coffin, and his guest. Be right there. Bruce, take it away.
Thank you, Pam. I got to tell you, it gives me great pleasure to introduce one of my favorite authors. I don't get to play fanboy that often anymore because I'm busy writing, but Craig Johnson we have on the show tonight. He is the New York Times bestselling author of the Longmire Mysteries, the basis for the hit Netflix original series Longmire. And I assume everyone listening has seen that. If you haven't, you should. He is the recipient of the Western Writers of America Spur Award for Fiction, the Mountains and Plains Bookseller Award for Fiction, and several others that I can't pronounce without doing damage to them, so I will not. Let's just say he's a highly awarded author and well-deserving awarded author for his mystery series. I met Craig back in 2014 while attending the New England Crime Bake in Massachusetts, and Craig was the guest of honor of that year. And it was coincidentally my first year attending, so that was really a treat for me to get to hear and meet Craig. Craig, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Good to hear from you again, my friend.
Right? It's been a while, huh?
Yeah. It has. Like, but we're all kind of like rotating in our own little orbits here. Like, every once in a while we get to intersect, like, and it's always a joy to hear from you. Thank you.
Oh, no, my pleasure. This is my pleasure. I assume we would be meeting back out of the trail again somewhere at a conference, but this has been one crazy year, I guess, huh?
It has been. It has been. Like, it's a little weird like that. I mean, you know, the book was – it came out, like, I guess, you know, I think about a week ago like that, and I think it was all the way back in May, I believe, or maybe even earlier than that. Viking Penguin came out and said, yeah, we're not touring any of our authors until January. And so that was kind of the end of that, like that we kind of knew that we were going to be home. And I don't know. I mean, you know, I miss the road. Like, I miss being out, like getting shaking hands with people and signing books and talking with people and all that. But you've heard me say it before. My wife says that the reason I enjoy that so much is because we live in a town of 25, and I'm just shocked to see that many people, you know, out in the world, you know. So I think I've been living in quarantine
excuse.
For the last 16 years. I just haven't been aware of it. Like, so.
Good training for this, for sure.
It is.
Speaking of your new book, I've got to tell you, I really enjoyed the new one, Next to Last Stand.
Thank you.
And you had some news on that, right?
I did. We just got notified that that it landed at number 5 on the New York Times bestsellers list this week, which
is awesome.
You know, very exciting. Like at,
congratulations.
You know, I mean, with all the problems like that with, you know, trying to get books shipped, you know, and and then, you know, like the added, you know, distraction of, you know, not being able to be on tour and all that type of stuff. Like, it's a pretty fine showing. We're pretty happy with that, I have to admit.
Right. No, that's good. Does it feel, I mean, I know how it feels to me, but does it feel almost like a, like you got ripped off, like you didn't get a chance to go out and do that, you know, real tour that you do after
the
book comes out?
Yeah,
you know?
You're right. I think that's probably the best way to describe it, ripped off. Like, I think that's, you know, because you do. Like, I know my wife does, you know, to a great extent, like that, because, you know, I've got her here at the ranch, like, at, you know, in the nearest town is Ucross, Wyoming, population 25, here in, up on the Wyoming-Montana border. It's a beautiful place, like that, but I think she really enjoys those tours, like that. I mean, they take very, very good care of me. My publicist, Ben Patron, like that, and the fine folks at Viking Penguin, they take really good care of me for the tours. Like that, they send us to all these really magnificent bookstores, like that, and they put us up in these nice hotels, and, you know, you're eating in restaurants and all that. And so for a couple of weeks there, my wife gets to pretend that she leads another life. And I think she really kind of enjoys that, and maybe depends on it a little bit more than I do. I mean, for me, you know, whenever I heard that I wasn't going to be on tour, I was thinking to myself, oh, good, I can tear the floor out of my tack shed in my barn and redo it that week. Like, so, you know, just the glamour kind of sidesteps me a little bit of the time, I'm afraid.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true, right? Yeah, the ego boost is the thing I think we miss, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's you know, I mean, you can, I mean, you know, you and I both, like, have been to enough events, you know, that, you know, you can always tell whenever you're witnessing an author who'd really rather be somewhere else. I mean, you know, just because you write books, it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, you're going to be, you know, socially adept, like, or you're really going to enjoy, you know, the being around crowds of people and, you know, talking about your work and all that type of thing. I mean, we've all been to those events where, you know, it's painful like that because, you know, authors by nature, I think, you know, are a little bit introverted. But, you know, there's also that part of you like that likes to kind of break out like that and, you know, and meet those people and see those people. I mean, that's one of the great joys, I think, of what it is that we do, you know, that wonderful
right.
interaction that you get to have. I mean, in the modern day, I think, you know, there are a lot of periods in time when a lot of authors did not have the opportunities that we've got. I mean, you know, emails every day, social media, you know, all of these things, you know, that allow you to, you know, actually have, you know, input, you know, from your readers, like that, and a response,
right.
like that. And, you know, I mean, my gosh, you know, if you're not looking for any kind of response and you don't want to hear from your readers, well, you might as well just, you know, do an Emily Dickinson and fill up the walls, you know, with your writing and
right.
you know, make insulation out of it or something. But,
right.
but
yeah,
we live
what
in a kind of
for?
A unique time.
Yep, no, that's true. I wanted to say I was fascinated by the historical aspect of Next to Last Stand. You've got Custer in there, a little Bighorn, an art heist. How much research did you have to do in writing this one?
It was a lot. You know what that's like. I mean, whenever you're going to, like, step on, you know, a stone that's been, you know, well-trod before, you know, boy,
mm-hmm.
you know, you better make sure you get your P's and Q's, you know, because, you know, somebody's going to catch you. Somebody's going to come back, like, and, you know, and try and, like, trip you up and find out what it is that you did wrong or the things that you might have, you know, left out that they thought were important or things that you, you know, included that they didn't think were particularly true, like that. And I started doing the research. I mean, well, the Little Bighorn's about 90 miles up the road, you know, from where my ranch
mm-hmm.
is. And so it's local history, you know, as far as, you know, we're concerned like that. But the other thing about it is that it's kind of an epic point in, you know, Western history. You know, it's kind of huge.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to try and take it on like that and include it in a book is, you know, kind of a rabbit hole that you can fall into like that and, you know, never come back out. You know, I mean,
sure.
we're all guilty of, like, over-researching or, you know, getting too far into a subject, you know, for the good of the novel, you know, to be honest. And so
right.
I'd always held, you know, the Little Bighorn at kind of like an arm's reach. But I stumbled onto that painting, you know, Cassili Adams' Custer's Last Fight, and I started doing a little bit of research on that, like that, and it was very interesting to me, like, you know, and this was, like, you know, I said, about 8 years ago, and it was kind of interesting because I was doing the research, starting to do the research for this book, when the first season of Longmire was being produced, and it was
oh.
a wonderful relationship with the producers of the TV show. And that they were always asking me, well, what are you working on? What are you doing now? You know, what things have you got in mind for Walt in the future? And, you know, I mentioned, you know, the fact that Cassili Adams' painting, you know, had been destroyed and, you know, what if it wasn't, you know, and all these things. Like,
right.
well, they included that as a subplot in, I think, the second or third episode of the first season. And so it's been interesting to see how many people have written me and said, did you get the idea for this book from that episode of the TV show? And I'm like, no, that was the other way around, actually. But yeah, you know, I mean, and I kind of tend to do what I refer to as, like, creek bed, you know, research. In the sense that, you know, I don't take a lot of notes, you know, or copious, you know, amounts of notes, you know, on the subject matter that I'm working on. Generally, what I do is just, you know, read to the point of distraction. And then when I sit down to write, what I remember, you know, the things that stuck in my memory or the things that stuck, you know, in that research that, you know, were maybe different or, you know, exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Things that, you know, maybe I hadn't, you know, heard or seen before, those are the things that need to be conveyed, you know, to the reader, because if they're of interest to me, then they might be of interest to them.
Right.
So by the time you're done doing the research, you know, by the time you look into the creek bed and through the water, those shiny bits that are laying on top of the creek bed, that's the part that needs to go in there.
Right. No, that's great. That's a great way to think about it, actually. I got to say, as usual, your characters jump right off the page for me. Even the newly introduced ones. I mean, I love getting to revisit some of the old characters from the series.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to ask you, the waivers from the Soldiers and Sailors Home, did you base those on real people that you knew or met? Or
Absolutely, absolutely. Like at the, we're right outside of Buffalo, Wyoming. Like at, you know, it's a little town of about 5,000 people. Like at, and it's the basis for Durant in the book.
Okay.
Like at, and about maybe 5 miles outside of it is Fort McKinney. Like at one of the forts that was built in response to the Indian threat of the Little Bighorn, which really wasn't much of a threat, but it was a great way to boost the economy of a lot of small communities, you know, here on the high plains. And
right.
They built Fort McKinney up there, like, and it it was stayed Fort McKinney, I think, until about the turn of the century. I think about 1903 or so, they handed it over to the state. And Wyoming took it over, and they made it the Wyoming Veterans Home, or at that point in time, the Wyoming Soldier and Sailor's Home. And it's a beautiful facility up there. I mean, an absolute, with a parade grounds and some of these old buildings like that are, you know, like antique, you know, buildings and vintage and, you know, beautiful facility, all modern and all of this too. Like that, but right there at the base of the Bighorn Mountains, you know, with Clear Creek running right down through the middle of it, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful spot, you know, for these veterans like that to you know, to spend the rest of their lives. Like that, it's a nice spot to be in. And yes, sir, some of them used to roll their wheelchairs out there, you know, to the big sign out by 16, the road that runs right by my ranch, like at, and they would sit out there and wave at the traffic. And I think for them it was a way of kind of still staying in touch, you know, to still
right.
kind of be in interaction, you know, with the common populace. Like at, and, you know, me, I'm always looking for a story. I'm always, you know, looking for somebody interesting to talk to or somebody that's got a story to tell. Like at, and I knew these guys had stories. There was no doubt in my mind.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
was the case. Like, and so I would stop and, you know, sit and talk with these guys. Like, I had to sit there, you know, on the tailgate of my truck, like, and just talk to them for a while. Like, and they were fantastic. Like, they just, you know, were so full of energy, so full of these stories, like, and excited, you know, to tell you about, you know, what had happened to them and what, you know, in their lives. And it was just an incredible opportunity. The only time I got into trouble was every once in a while, you know, when I first started stopping, they would ask me to get them beer. And so every once in a while I would grab a six pack and drop it off with them. Well, then the people, the administrators informed me that, you know, some of those guys were on medication and shouldn't have alcohol, and I could not bring them beer. Like, and so, you know, I stopped bringing them beer, but I would still stop every once in a while and, you know, drop off a hamburger like that, or, you know, a bag of chips
right.
or something to sit and talk with the guys. But yeah, they became the waivers like that. So
that's awesome. They were corrupting you.
Yeah, they were.
They're
absolutely.
Great.
My innocence.
Lovely.
I had
characters.
No idea.
That's awesome. Hey, let me take you back to the beginning for a second. You know, I mean, your success you've had with this series is phenomenal, and I think well-deserved, too. Great characters all the way around, and especially Walt. When you were writing Cold Dish, the first one in the series, did you ever, in your wildest dreams, imagine that you'd have this kind of success with this series? Or that
no.
there would be a series?
No, not at all. Like I wrote it as a, you know, a standalone book. And then the, you know, I mean, whenever anybody asks that question, I'm always thinking to myself, well, you know, if I was shooting for a demographic, I probably wouldn't have written about the sheriff of the least populated county in the least populated state in America. I probably would have shot for something with maybe a little bit more of a connection, you know, to a population
right.
base, like that, as a readership like that. But I don't know, in some ways it kind of worked, you know, and I had some things in mind, you know, that, you know, it was, you know, kind of like an anti-technology kind of thing. It seemed like an mm-hmm. awful lot of the crime fiction that I was reading was very technologically oriented, with cell phones and computers and all that
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. And I don't know. I'm not against, you know, technology as a, you know, as a, you know, an aspect or, you know, a facet, you know, within, you know, what it is that we do for a living like that. But I it has a limited interest for me, whereas, you know, character and place, you know, are always going to have a great deal of attraction for me.
Right.
And so, you know, I thought, you know, maybe Wyoming, you know, I look at these sheriffs and I see, you know, that, you know, here in Wyoming, I mean, we have counties that are as big as Maryland, you know, and so, and these guys, you know, they don't have a lot of resource to work with, you know, both financially and as far as their personnel is concerned. Like, they're stretched kind of thin, and they really kind of have to do whatever. They have to, you know, whatever comes up, they have to deal with it. And most
right.
generally, there isn't any backup. You know, generally, you're on your own, you know, when you're out there, you know, 60 miles down a gravel road, you know, where there's a domestic disturbance at a ranch or something. You know, you just
mm-hmm.
have to respond, you know, and try and take care of the situation. And I don't know, it you know, makes you focus more on character and place And to me, that's always where the best writing is. You know, that's always seems to be the stuff that I respond to.
It's funny you say that. I've got some other friends that were formerly law enforcement that have written novels, and we talk about that, how, you know, the technology, even though it can be fascinating, almost is like a crutch. The old writing, the stuff that we all grew up reading, was really about the human condition and the interaction of people, you know.
I'm okay with reading about, you know, a rifle for, you know, a paragraph or two, like, you know, or, you know, a piece of technology for a paragraph or two, but I'll read about a character for an entire novel. You know, people are going to be interesting to me. Like, it always goes back to that, you know, the old Charles Dickens quote that, you know, any you know, author worth his salt is going to have to be, you know, a student of human nature. That's the part that's really going to be interesting. And I laugh about the technology here in Wyoming because I can always tell immediately, you know, when somebody says, why doesn't Walt carry a cell phone? And I can always tell that they've never been to Wyoming. Because unless you've got, you know, antennas, unless you've got towers, you know, that provide service for those things, they're kind of useless. And so, you know, unless you want to take selfies with pronghorn antelope, they're really not that much use in most of Wyoming. So
that's true. That's awesome. Walt himself, I guess, I'd have to describe him as the quintessential Wild West lawman. How much of yourself did you use or have you used in constructing his character?
Well, I think when you write a person in first person, whenever you're writing a character in first person, you know, you're not going to escape from them too far. So there's going to be a certain amount of them, maybe more importantly, a certain amount of you that's going to leak, you know, into that character, especially, you know, if it's more than one book. I mean, The Cold Dish was intended to be a standalone novel, and then Catherine Court, who at that point in time was the president of Penguin, sat me down and said, we really think you should consider, you know, writing some more of these. We think these people and this place, and we think they have the stories like that people are going to want to hear more of. And, you know, but a certain amount of you is going to leak into those characters after a certain period in time, whether you want it to or not. But then, you know, there's also my wife's quote, which is, Walt is who Craig would like to be in 10 years. He's just off to an incredibly slow start. And, you know, there's probably more truth to that than I'm willing to admit either. He has some incredible traits that, you know, I aspire to. He's patient, you know, he's extraordinarily dogged, you know. I mean, he's just the last person that you want after you like that, because he's the guy that's going to knock on one more door. He's the guy that's going to make one more phone call. He's the guy that's going to do one more drive and take a look at the crime scene just one more time to see if he might have missed something like that. And, you know, he's also got an incredibly, you know, big heart. I think he just, you know, he really cares. You know, I think he exemplifies a lot of, you know, what I consider to be some of the best parts of, you know, not only of law enforcement, but also just of humanity. I mean, he really cares about people. They're his people. That was a quote that I heard over and over again, you know, when I was doing ride-alongs, you know, with sheriffs here in Wyoming and up Montana. The thing they would say over and over again was, my people, my people. They take it very personally. And, you know, in using a sheriff, you know, it also made a kind of an accessibility factor with the character, too, because I think that there are people who would never walk into a police office in their lives. They would never walk into a police headquarters in their entire lives. But they will march right into a sheriff's office and say, hey, so-and-so is putting up a new fence, and it's on my property, and I voted for you, and so you need to – it's one of those deals. I mean, they're invested.
Awesome.
You know, they've actually given you, you know, one of the most treasured things they have, you know, in a democracy, their vote. They've given that to you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they hold you responsible for that, you know, and you need to answer to it, you know. And that kind of makes Walt, you know, into that kind of like neighborhood policing like that, you know, where, you know, hopefully he can stop a lot of the problems before they actually get started. But I think, you know, there are a lot of qualities he has, but then again, he's also got a lot of tragedies in his life. He's had a lot of sorrows in his life that I've never, you know, had to contend with. You know, the fact that whenever I was, you know, contemplating the character, I kind of put him together and thought, okay, you know, I'm going to give him these abilities. You know, he's not going to be perfect, you know, but I'm going to give him a few, you know, abilities like that'll, you know, give him an advantage in some situations. And you know, and here I had, you know, this guy who was, you know, a Vietnam veteran, a Marine investigator, you know, an offensive lineman for USC. My gosh, he's like 6'5", 257 pounds, you know, and all this. Like, and the first thing I thought was, How can I cripple him? What can I do to him, you know, to bring him back to earth here? Like, and I thought, well, what's the one thing I can take away from him? Like, that'll, you know, be, you know, something he'll never completely get over, you know. And I thought, I'm going to take his wife away. I'm going to take his wife away like that, and
yep.
never going to be something he's going to completely be able to recover from. And
right.
that kind of goes back, though, to like a, you know, an old statement, an old proverb, you know, that you love people, you know, for their virtues. You know, I mean, you like people for their virtues, but you love them for their faults.
Yeah.
You know, it's the things that are wrong with people, the things that are, you know, not right, like that make them infinitely more attractive. And
mm-hmm.
any, you know, kind of strength, you know, that character is going to have has to be counterbalanced, you know, by a weakness.
Right.
That was exemplified in one of the books, As the Crow Flies. You know, once Walt, you know, gets his nose down, he's like a bloodhound, you know, and he gets he catches the scent, look out, because he's off and gone like that. Well, imagine living with someone like that. Imagine, like, being the daughter of somebody like that, or married to somebody like that, or the husband of somebody like that. It's
right.
always going to be like there's one thing that's more important than you are, always.
Right.
And,
right.
and that makes for a difficult kind of a situation, I think, for a family to kind of have to survive like that. And Katie, you know, kind of voices that to him. You know, Dad, there was always a case. There was always a case.
Right.
And,
yep.
You know, I think that's kind of the fun thing, to try and find those strengths and weaknesses and try and find that balance point, that fulcrum like that's right there, that's going to give you that balance point for those characters.
Well, you hit the mark well. As somebody that used to do that kind of a job for almost 3 decades, I can tell you hit the mark. Sometimes the job forces you to put, you know, the family in the back seat. So
yeah. I mean, there's
well.
No choice. I mean, that's the
yep.
thing. Like, and then, you know, the other major component, I think, is humor. You know, I think you have to, you know, include humor in these types of books. I'm always amazed, you know, whenever someone doesn't have humor in their books. I mean, it's understandable, because if you don't have a sense of humor, or if you don't write, you know, aren't quite sure how to write with a sense of humor, I can see why it is that you would avoid it. The other thing is it's a little bit of a double-edged sword like that, because humor is a difficult thing in that, you know, it's a personal kind of sensibility. I mean, you know, somebody, you're taking a chance when you include humor in your books, because not everybody has the same sense of humor. And so you might alienate people, or you might, you know, upset people, or you might bore people. They might not think that what you think is funny is funny. But
right.
for me, the essential element there was to have it included in the books, because it's a defense mechanism is what it is. It's a way you survive.
Exactly.
Exactly. There's no way. I mean, you know, I think that Walt makes the statement early on in the series, like that a sense of humor is more important than a bulletproof vest. You know, it'll keep you going a lot longer than the other one will. Because, I mean, you go home at the end of the day like that, you know, and you have to, you know, carry all that stuff with you. And so you better have a little bit of a sense of humor to keep you going.
Yep. Right on. I noticed one of the things I love about your books is, some authors that write series seem to take a formulaic approach to what they're writing. And I can say, honestly, every one of the Longmire novels have a distinct feel to them. They all seem different. And I love that, because I can actually pick up a book and know which one it is and that I've read it already, as opposed to it seemed like all the others, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I've had that happen with other writers. Do you do this intentionally? Or
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Is the
absolutely.
Story sort of shape the book as you go?
No, I think, you know, when I'm thinking about one like that, I'm always thinking, you know, okay, where is this book, you know, in the chronology?
Mm-hmm.
Where is this book, you know, with the characters? I mean, that's a big thing when I'm thinking about a plot. I'm always thinking, okay, well, you know, how is this going to advance these characters? How is this going to enhance their development in where they are right now in this life, this arc that I've given them? You have to take that into consideration. You think about, you know, okay, well, is it a social problem? Is it something that's, you know, relevant? Is it something that's
mm-hmm.
important, you know, to make a commentary on at this point in time like that? And then it can also be something as basic as, you know, that seasonal aspect of the books. You know, it takes me 4 books to get through 1 year of Walt's life. You know, I took some advice from Tony Hillerman, like it, who said, you know, you need to find a framework, you know, for your work. Like it, and I thought, well, what's the biggest thing that has a large scale effect, you know, on us in the West? And I know it's the same in Maine, for goodness sake. Like, you know, it's the weather. You know, you have to be aware of, you know, what the weather is going to do. Like that, and you know, I thought, okay, well then fine, I'll do a Vivaldi is what I'll do. Like it, and so I pulled the Four Seasons, like it, and have Walt, you know, have to go through, you know, the Four Seasons simply because it does give you a different environment for each book. You know,
right.
I mean, Wyoming
right.
in January is nothing like Wyoming in July.
Right.
And so it gives you a completely different environment for each book. But then again, you know, each season is going to kind of enhance, you know, whatever the storyline happens to be. I mean, this was a book that I had in mind, you know, almost 8 years ago, but I had to get all the research done. And then when I finally got it done, it was winter, like in the book
right.
world. And I thought, okay, I can't do this. You know, nobody's going to go up to the Little
right.
Bighorn in the right mind in the wintertime and all these things happening, you know, where they're going all over the
right.
state. You know, I thought, I'm going to have to put this one on hold. Like it. So I just took this book and, you know, put it up on the shelf, like it, and just kind of waited until the proper season rolled around like that. And then
right.
and then started off on it again. But to go back, you know, more specifically to your question, I mean, it's got to hold your interest. I mean, you know, Bruce, like, I mean, the most horrifying thing in the world that could ever possibly happen would be if you got started on a book and then, you know, ran out of gas, you know, halfway
right.
through. I mean, you really have to make sure that you've got, you know, more gas than you're ever going to possibly need,
right.
you know, to get through this novel like that. And yeah, I mean, it's got to stay interesting to you, you know, I mean. If it's going to get boring with you, it's going to get boring to the reader. Like, and so you need to constantly
right.
be searching and stretching and maybe taking some chances. I mean, there's always going to be, you know, some readers that are going to write and say, I didn't like the latest book, you know, and my immediate response to that is, don't worry, the next one is completely different, you know. And so, you know,
right.
you
right.
just kind of have to, you know, keep evolving a little bit and changing a little bit, or else, you know, then if you don't, you fall into that. What a horrifying artistic, pit, you know, to fall into where you're just, you know, going through the motions and, you know, recycling the same formulaic stuff over and over again. That just sounds like a certain specific
hell.
Little pocket of hell is what that sounds
right.
like to me.
Right. It does too. Writer hell.
Yeah,
I think that's what
yeah.
it is. We've got to be careful, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh, yes. You know, and I think, you know, you have to risk things like that. I mean, do you have to risk a certain amount of your readership or risk a certain amount of your
right.
success, all those things like that to do that? Yeah, you do.
Sure.
But, boy, you know, it's artistic death, you know, to ignore it, seems to me.
Yeah, that's great advice. I got to ask you, probably most writers have never been in this position, and enviable or unenviable, I'm not sure which, but fiction writers, we tend to spend most of our days hanging out with our imaginary friends of our own creation. And,
right.
and I got to know, how awesome was it for you to actually see your characters come to life on screen in the Longmire series?
You know, you hear these horror stories, and that's kind of how I approached it. I mean, you know, all the way back from Faulkner, you know, forward, you know, that their experiences, you know, with Hollywood, you know, were terrible and they had a horrible time and all of these things
right.
like that. But I was extraordinarily fortunate. I mean, you know, I was on my eighth book, I think, you know, whenever Warner Brothers got in touch with me. And so,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm trying to think. I think I just made it on the New York Times bestsellers list at that point, like that, but just barely. And,
right.
you know, I was not Stephen King. I was not John Grisham. You know, I was not Lee Child. Like, you know, so I,
right.
you know, it wasn't like I could go to Hollywood and dictate, you know, what exactly it was that I wanted and how I wanted it done. But
right.
it's kind of like any other work, you know, and the analogy that I always make is that it's kind of like a, excuse me, it's kind of like a ranch. You or any other line of work, you know, you hire get in partnership with the very best people that you can get, and then you do the hardest
mm-hmm.
thing in the world. You leave them alone. You let them do what
right.
they do, for goodness sake, like,
yeah.
and don't interfere. And
right.
and I was very careful. You know, I took a good, strong, hard look at the people that were involved with the production of Longmire, like, and they just seemed like the right people to take this on like that. And, of course, one of the big jobs, you know, that they're going to do right off the bat was try and cast it. And you
mm-hmm.
know, some people know, some people don't like that. But one of the aspects of the television show before it got picked up was that it was cast contingent, that they would not make the TV show unless all parties agreed, that both, you know, the producing studio, the broadcasting network, the producers, everybody would agree on who it was that would play Walt Longmire. And so it was kind of like a difficult process, you know, because, I mean, there are a couple of ways of looking at it in the sense that, you know, you could get somebody who was a big name and use them as the character, or you could, you know, try and find somebody who was a relative unknown or like had not played this type of character before. And I thought they did a remarkable job, you know, when they came up with Robert Taylor to play that role. His DNA kind of matches, you know, Walt Longmire very, very well. And in a number of different ways. I mean, there's a lot of things that, like, you know, he's a big guy, you know, he's a regular guy. He kind of hides his light under a bush a little bit. He's a whole heck of a lot smarter than he lets on, which is very much, you know, the way Walt Longmire is. He tends to, you know, be the aw shucks, I'm just an old country sheriff kind of thing, you know, just as he closes the door and locks it on you. But I think that, you know, Robert had a number of things. I mean, and I guess, you know, other than just the physicality and his voice and all those things like that, I remember they were filming one of the first scenes, and he was doing an interrogation of a prisoner like that. And I remember the guest star that it was playing the role of the perp, like that was, you know, using a lot of gestures, a lot of facial gestures, and moving around a lot and all this kind of stuff. And Robert, on the other hand, asked his question and just sat there and looked at him. And after they finished the scene, I walked over to him like that, and I said, that was an interesting choice, you know, that you made to not move and not do anything. I said, you know, that's an old law enforcement routine. You ask your question and then you don't say anything else. You just sit there and wait, you know, and they'll talk and they'll tell you probably more than they really mean to tell you like that. But I said, you know, I'm interested in why it is that you made that choice. And he paused for a second and he goes, Craig Walt's a hunter. You know, if you're out hunting, you don't catch anything if you make a lot of noise and move around a lot. Like, and that's what he is and who he is.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, we made the right choice here.
Yeah, that's great.
This guy's going to work out.
That's awesome. So to follow up on that, I was reading at some point here recently that Ian Rankin has never watched the television series Rebus. And it was because he was afraid that it would change the way in which the characters that he had already – written were portrayed and it would affect his writing. I know you were very close when they were filming the series to go along with your books. And I personally now reading your books, I hear Lou Diamond Phillips' voice every time I read Henry Standing Bear's dialogue.
I will tell Lou you said that. He'll be very happy to hear
I love it. It's unbelievable. He nails that character.
He does. He does. He's got an incredible voice.
You
know what? No, not really. You know, because I had been writing the books, you know, for like about 8 years, you know, before, you know, the television show ever came around. Like, and like I was saying before, like about that quote, you know, from Wallace Stegner about teaching and writing fiction, you know, the disclaimer at the beginning of every book is that, you know, none of these characters are based off anybody alive or dead. I mean, you know, Lucian Connolly, you know, the old sheriff that Walt goes and plays chess with on Tuesday nights, that's my dad.
Yeah.
You know, and
really?
I can go down. Vic is my wife, like, and so I can go down the list of all the characters and tell you, you know, all of the people that they're based on. And as powerful, you know, as a medium as it is, you know, television and film, it's never going to be quite as powerful as, you know, your intimate friends and family and all that. I mean, you know, you kind of know actors and actresses, you know, by what they're doing on the screen, but you don't really know them, you know, for goodness sake. You know, they're a flickering image is what they are. Whereas, you know, your friends and your family and people you've worked with your whole life and that type of thing, you know them. You know, you don't have to search, you know, for, you know, what their response to certain things are going to be. For me, a lot of it, it's audible, a lot of it. You know, I mean, whenever I'm teaching classes, I'm always telling students, you know, that you get to describe a character one time, but you're going to have that character speak all the way through the novel. And so the best thing to do is try and find, you know, a very strong differentiation and a defined voice for that character more than anything else. Because, you know, they're going to talk all the way through that novel like that. And you want to be so defined in those voices that you don't have to remind the reader every time who it is that's speaking. You know, so that hopefully they'll be able to pick it up, you know, after a certain period of time that they know which character that is that's talking. And, you know, I never have to search for those voices. You know, I always know what my father would say in any given situation. I know what my wife Judy would say, you know, in any given situation like that. And that just, you know, that's kind of hard to override, kind of hard for Hollywood to overcome that.
I got to say, and maybe you're just putting me at ease, but I'll pretend that it's for the fellow fans. The Next to Last Stand. It's the 16th Longmire novel. Am I right on that? 16?
Mm-hmm. Yep, you are.
And within the book, I read passages and obviously the title that made me worry that you were considering ending the series. So tell me I'm way off base here. And I'll tell the fans.
You are not alone in that. You are not alone in that at all. Like, I think it obviously stems from the title. I think that you know, Next to Last Stand, and of course,
that's just
me trying to be funny. You know, in hopes that, like, you know, Walt would see this as a situation where it's not going to be his last stand, maybe the next, but not the totally last stand, like that. But no, absolutely not. I love writing Walt Longmire. Like, I've enjoyed writing Walt Longmire for 16 years, and I hope to write him for another 16 years. Like, I have a long arc for this character, you know, in all of these storylines that I've got, like, you know, piled away in these file folders that are just waiting, you know, for the opportunity. You know, they're like, it's like a horse race, you know, that, you know, when you're judging storylines, you know, for future novels, it's almost like being a, you know, a gambler at a, you know, at a horse race. Like, you know, you're looking at that story and you're thinking, yeah, that one might go the distance. He's got a bottom to him. I think he'll make it, like,
right.
You know, and pretty soon you've got, you know, all of these storylines that are just chomping at the bit, and they're the ones that want to win the race. They're the ones that want to go out, you know, and be written, you know, and I've got, you know, so many, I'm never going to get them all written, Bruce, before I pass away, like that, you know. That's the way I want to go. I want to go, you know, and typing the end, you know, and then just fall over the keyboard, you know. I think that, you know, Robert Parker, I think, you know, nailed it for us, like as far as that was concerned. But you know, for me, you know, a joy, you know, to write the books. I haven't, you know, tired of them at all, like that. And I keep coming up with ideas, you know, for standalone books, but then I'll be, you know, like asleep and have a dream, and Walt Longmire will come and knock on the door and say, yeah, that's one of my stories too. That one, you go ahead and just, you know, make that a Walt Longmire story. Like, and so I have yet to get around him yet, so we'll see what happens.
Excuse me for interrupting.
Cool.
Craig, would you like to take a call from a fan?
Sure.
Okay. Let's see. Hi, area code 603. You're live on the air. Who says?
Hi, this is Helen DePrima. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Craig, it was an honor to meet you years ago on your stop in Milford, New Hampshire, and we'd sure love to see you back again. And I really appreciate your kindness and your encouragement for my own efforts and it's your writing is so, still so far above my level that it makes my teeth hurt. But
yes, but
thank
in
you
writing
for all you've given
in your own way, you're way ahead of me. Like that, so.
Well, I'm working on my fifth novel now, so I guess
cool.
I'm not feeling too badly.
That's fantastic.
Do you have a question? Do you have a question for Craig? Okay.
Although I think Craig's already answered it. I'm doling this book out slowly, not to come to the end, and it had sort of an elegiac feel that scared me a little bit, but now I'm reassured to know that Walt is going to be coming on strong for quite some time in the future.
That's a
nice
way to describe it, too, like that, because I think, you know, that, yeah, if you don't, you know, if you don't genuinely have, you know, the characters imperiled, and there isn't at least, you know, the possibility, you know, that something could happen, like that, then, you know, you're really not raising the stakes high enough, you know, to utilize, you know, as far as a murder mystery is concerned. So I'm actually glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that, like, you know, you were just a little bit worried. Like, you know, Walt's getting a little bit longer in the tooth, like that, so it's going to be something he's kind of thinking about, you know, on a periodic basis, like that. So I can't deny, like, that those elements are there.
Well, I told you people were worried.
Thank you so much for your call.
That's part of the tension.
Thank you so much
for
calling in.
Thank you.
Okay, you're back. Go ahead, and I'll hop off.
Just a couple more, Craig. I don't want to keep you. I know you've had a busy schedule here. There is a thing to the people that are listening that aren't familiar called Longmire Days. Can you kind of give us a little bit of a background on that?
How'd that get
started? It's basically an unnatural disaster that happens here in Buffalo, Wyoming, is what it is. When we first started doing it, the Chamber of Commerce came over to me, from Buffalo. Angela Fox, who was the head of the chamber at that point in time, got in touch with me and said, "Hey, we'd like to do a Longmire Day." Is what we'd like to do. And I was like, okay, what would you like me to do? And she said, "Well, just sit out in front of the Busy Bee Cafe and sign books underneath an umbrella." And I was like, okay, well, that's a pretty low-impact event. I think I can probably handle that. And so I did, and we were kind of surprised, that about 100 people showed up, just for me under a tent, which was, kind of crazy because I live here, So it was a little bit of a shocker to us. The Office of Tourism sent some camera people up, and they, did a little mini documentary, a good buddy of mine, Chuck Kuhn, Mike, his buddy, they came up and, did some filming. And, when we got finished, they looked at me and they said, "Well, do you think, you think it's possible to get the actors from the TV show to come to Longmire Days?" And I said, "Well, I don't have any idea." I said, I could ask, I said, "Which ones do you want?" And they said, "All of them." And I was like, "Okay, I'll see what I can do." And amazingly enough, that kind of gives you an indication of just how gracious and how wonderful, the actors are that we have in our show. I mean, even above and beyond the fact that they included themselves, in this tour that I did for Next to Last Stand, not only doing readings, for the events, but also accompanying me, virtually, in every single one of the events. They all agreed, and they all came. Wow. And so suddenly Longmire Days was, being populated by over 15,000 people in this little town of 5,000 people in northern Wyoming. And, I remember that next year was just an utter disaster. I mean, in a humorous sense, all the grocery stores and restaurants ran out of food. All the ATM machines and banks ran out of money. It was hilarious. It was a natural disaster was what it was like. And, they're all, so extraordinarily approachable and gracious and everything. And, we give, the proceeds go to a number of different charities. And, it's a nominal charge, to go to the events. I think it's $1 or $5, according to the event or whatever. And I remember there was one woman that called me, or not called me, but wrote me. And she was very angry because she didn't get into the one event with Robert Taylor that she wanted to get into because she wanted to get her book signed or a photo signed or something. And I remember writing her back and going, "You do realize that if you just stand out in front of the Occidental Hotel Saloon and hold Robert's beer, he'll sign whatever you want, okay?" It's a very low-key kind of event as far as that thing is concerned. I mean, the actors aren't behind velvet ropes or anything like that. They're very, very accessible and just utterly, utterly charming. Just a wonderful group.
That's
of
awesome.
And we've got all our 10th anniversary. We had a virtual one this year, which was a great success. Our 10th anniversary for Longmire Days is coming up next year towards the end of July, I think, again. And, boy, I think everybody's going to be there again next year, and it should be big. Mark that on your calendar, folks.
That sounds like fun. Yeah. No, it sounds like fun. So let me put you on the spot with your last question. It's probably like kids. You're not supposed to have a favorite, but give me your favorite Longmire novel.
Oh, well, and you're right. That's like asking somebody their favorite child while all the kids are in the room. You can't do that. Well, it varies. It varies from mood to mood, interest to interest. I mean, it goes back a little bit to what you were saying, about trying to make each book different. I mean, whenever somebody comes up to me and says, "I'd like to start the Longmire series, which book should I start with?" Obviously the simplest answer would be The Cold Dish, to just start out with the first book, because you do get indulgences as a writer that you can, take part in with a debut novel that you can't in subsequent novels without being repetitious. The first thing I always ask people is what do you like to read? I guess I sound a little bit like an independent bookseller, which is kind of one of the things I love about independent bookstores is that, it's not all books for all people. They ask readers, who do they like? And what do you like to read? Do you like humor? Do you like history? Do you like character development? Do you like multiple narratives? Do you like singular narrative? I mean, all these kind of things that you can ask people and kind of hone hone down, you know, which book it is that, that they might like. And, you know, for me, it changes all the time like that. You know, I do tend to loop back around, you know, with some of my books. I mean, with this one, you know, an awful lot of this book, you know, takes place up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. And, of course, the next book I'm writing almost exclusively takes place up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. And so I had to loop back around and read As a Crow Flies, the eighth, the eighth book, I believe the ninth book, I believe it is, in the series, because it takes place up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. And I, you know, I knew, okay, I've got to go back and, you know, reread that book, eighth book in the series. And I had to go back and, you know, listen to that one again. I do have the added benefit, though, of having my good friend George Guidel, who does the audiobooks. And, you know, one of the occupational hazards of living in Wyoming is you got to drive everywhere. And so I just take those CDs, you know, of whichever book it is I need to go back over, and I just slip them in the CD player and have George read my book back to me.
That's
and
excellent.
It's kind of handy.
He does a great job.
He does.
He does
a marvelous job.
Very good. Well, Pam, I think you're on.
It's been such a fascinating conversation. But Craig, I have two questions for you as a reader, because obviously I'm not a writer. What changes have you seen in Walt since book one to today's release?
Oh, I think, you know, whenever we first meet Walt in the cold dish, you know, Martha, his wife, has only been dead for a couple of years, like, and he's angry. He's an enraged soul, you know, no two ways about it, like that. And you know, for him, you know, he feels like he's made this, you know, contract, you know, with, you know, the universe, like that, that, you know, that everybody's going to play on an even playing field, you know, and it's all going to be decent, it's all going to be good, and everybody's going to get treated fairly. And for making that sacrifice, he has the most important thing in his life taken away from him. And, you know, I think when it first starts out, he's clinically depressed. He's in, you know, his soul is enraged, you know, and he's very, very much off balance, like at when we first meet him. And, you know, through the job and through this, like, cadre of, you know, friends and family and close associates and people that he works with who will not let him go. They're not going to let him, you know, go into that dark night. They're going to hang on to him and, you know, and keep him alive. And he continues to grow in the humanity of the character. He comes more and more back to life, like at as these cases evolve, you know, and his life continues. Like that, he's able to reinvigorate, you know, his soul, you know, to the extent to where, you know, he's a working human being once again.
I love that, because if you don't see character growth, you're reading the same book over and over again.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I have one other question for you, and that is, what's changed about you since the first Longmire book to the current release?
Oh, my goodness, what has changed about me? I think Bruce can maybe respond to this, too, like that, but, you know, one of the nice things is that, you know, to learn how to write, you have to write. And I think when I first started out, I was not very, you know, secure, you know, in what I was doing. Like, I mean, one of the things I didn't mention was that, you know, when I wrote the first draft of The Cold Dish, it was over 650 pages long. It was like War and Peace in Absaroka County was what it was like. Like, I put everything in that book because I thought, you know what, if I fool anybody into publishing this, they're never going to publish another one like it. And so I'm putting everything into this. Like, and I think, you know, you're very insecure in what it is that you're doing. Like, and then the only thing that can provide that kind of intellectual security, the only thing that can make you feel as though what you're doing is worthwhile and really, you know, worth doing, like that, is to just continue writing. That was really wonderful, you know, when the reader called in like that and said she was on her fifth book. That's just wonderful news. I mean, that you're capable of, like, you know, continuing on, and you know, and it's the only way. It's the only way is to sit down, you know, and putting those words on paper like that. And I think that a more confident writer makes for a better writer. Certainly some of the mistakes that I made, you know, in my early books, you know, I don't make those same mistakes. I make different, you know, mistakes now.
Like, sure.
But nonetheless, you know, you evolve. You evolve in what it is that you're doing. And I think that also helps because that changes the voice, you know, of the books and the character and the tone and the structure of the books, you know, as you move forward, too.
Yes, I have to. Well, I have to agree with you that character and place are exceptionally important as a reader of 400 books a year across genres. So I read a lot of books, and I don't have a television, which is why I get to read. But much to my happiness. Craig, I cannot thank you enough for taking your time to come to Authors on the Air and with my friend Bruce Coffin, who himself is an award-winning author. So will you please tell everyone where is the best place to find information about you and Walt Longmire? Maybe your website?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, the website that I've got is CraigAllenJohnson.com, CraigAllenJohnson.com. It's usually got, you know, all the up-to-date information about, you know, the tours, the books, and everything like that. And then also there's a Facebook page, Craig Johnson, and it's got a blue check mark. I think it's official, I believe it is. Then Instagram, like that, and all the other things like that, you know, and it's UCrossPop25, as in UCross Population 25, our little town out here where our ranch is. Like that.
It has been an honor and a pleasure having you back. Bruce Coffin, I know I owe you so many interviews, but you know, we finally got one done this year. When is your new book coming out? When is your new book coming out?
What, you talking about me?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, we're still working on that. We're working on the fifth one.
My fourth one
is still, I'm in the process of zooming that up this year, so I'm a little behind Craig, but he is. You've given me some inspiration tonight, so I appreciate that, Craig.
Yeah. Will you tell us your website?
What a wonderful conversation! Like, thank you so much, Bruce.
Thank you so much for being with us,
Bruce. Give us your website.
It's BruceRobertCoffin.com.
And
you
are very
all the usual places.
So I like that.
Yeah.
It has been just a joy to listen to you. I've been off the air for over a month now, and so this was the perfect show for me to come back and listen to. Thank you so much, Craig Johnson and Bruce Coffin. Stay safe. Have a wonderful holiday if I don't speak to you again sooner. And have a great day, everybody. Glad you joined me. See you later. Authors on the Air is copyrighted by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Thanks for listening, everybody, and thank you, Mom and Dad. See ya.